For 2 decades, Kyle Gann chronicled New York's downtown music scene as a critic for the Village Voice. Although raised in Texas, he knew the turf back when Soho was a barren wilderness of artist lofts and experimental music. Today on Soundcheck, he'll discuss his forthcoming book, Music Downtown, Writings from the Village Voice. We'll also get a taste of his own music, including the provocative new album, Nude Rolling Down an Escalator, and an ambient piano work called Long Night. And we'll visit with Korean-born soprano Sumi Jo. She's one of today's leading coloratura sopranos, and her vocal acrobatics will be on display this weekend at the Caramore Festival in upstate New York. She'll star as a sleepwalker in Bellini's opera La Sonnambula. She'll walk us through that role, yes, pun intended, I'm afraid, on Soundcheck after the news. This is Soundcheck at 93.9 WNYC and online at WNYC.org. I'm John Schaefer. The downtown music scene needs to be recognized as an important genre with a rich tradition so that it doesn't get written off by the classical music establishment as being merely inferior. So writes Kyle Gann, composer himself, musicologist, teacher, and longtime music critic at the Village Voice. Kyle has 2 new releases, Long Night and the one you're hearing now called Nude Rolling Down an Escalator, Studies for Disclavier. And he has a forthcoming book called Music Downtown, drawn from his years of writing at the Village Voice. Kyle Gann, welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, John. Always nice to be here.
So we're listening here to this piece, Texarkana.
No, this is Cosmic Boogie Woogie.
Cosmic Boogie Woogie, okay. From the album Nude Rolling Down an Escalator.
Right.
Subtitled Studies for Disclavier. So what is the disclavier?
A disclavier is an acoustic piano, just like any other piano. You can play it, but it's an update on the player piano. It's played by computer instead of a piano roll.
So when you write a piece for the disclavier, what in fact are you doing notes on a piece of paper, or are you...
Actually, the way I do it is I write the piece in Sibelius notation software, because I'm usually using quite a few different tempos at a time, and I can do it. Sibelius will do that very easily. Then I transfer it as a MIDI file into Digital Performer, a sequencing program, clean it up there, get the dynamics the way I want to do that, and then use that to run the piano.
So you have like a little diskette or something? You stick into a little
slot in the piano?
No, it just
runs from the computer itself.
So there's a computer built
into
it. Got
a MIDI interface.
Yeah. And it's built into the piano.
Yeah. There's a box that on the piano that runs all the keys and everything.
Wow. So it is, as you say, a very modern updating of the player piano.
Yeah.
Now, one of the composers that you've long been fascinated by is Conlon Nancarrow, who in the middle of the 20th century basically gave up writing for humans and wrote for player piano.
Right.
On the theory that he too wanted to do lots of complex interrelations of rhythm, and he felt like people wouldn't be able to perform that. Is that for you the attraction of the disclavier?
Yeah, very much the same thing. In fact, I wrote a book about Conlon Nancarrow and learned a tremendous amount about the player piano and what you could do with that from him, from studying all of his music.
So is there some kind of restriction when you're writing for human performers that you feel like you're free of those restrictions when you're writing for this instrument?
Well, yeah, actually, you don't have to. You no longer have to worry about whether hands can play the notes. You can play the entire keyboard or notes all over the keyboard at once.
Mm-hmm.
I've always got, usually got a lot of tempos going on at the same time, and I love the sound of a sort of a cluster of different tempos that you get notes that are not, you get rhythms that are not random, but they kind of have kind of a bubbly, unpredictability to them.
Yeah. Well, you know, some of these pieces almost sound like, you know, a ragtime record gone amok.
Right.
There's this kind of weird retro sound at the same time that you're obviously using a very modern technology.
Yeah.
So what's the, what would you say is the thing for people to be listening to when there are three or four or five competing rhythms going simultaneously? Are we expected to make sense of all of this, or just kind of let it wash over you?
I think the effect is actually a more subtle one than that. In Texarkana, which is a ragtime piece with two different tempos going, one is the virtual left hand is 13 beats to the measure, and the virtual right hand is 29 beats to the measure. Hmm. And I tried different ratios before I got 13 to 29. And if the right hand was less than twice as fast, it sounded kind of clunky and hesitant. And over twice as fast, it sounds kind of over the top and overly excited and out of control. So,
but since you have it sort of at this perfect ratio, it sounds...
It's like the guy's playing a little faster than he can handle.
This is some of the music from writer and composer Kyle Gann. This piece is Texarkana from one of his two new recordings, this one called Nude Rolling Down an Escalator. Texarkana is a work not for a human performer at all, but for this instrument known as the disc clavier. It is a real piano, and
yep.
You can sit down and play
it. Acoustic, it's got strings inside, you can pluck them if you want to. And
mm-hmm. But it can also be played by this little computer, which is affixed, mm-hmm. as I recall, to the bottom of the instrument. Yep. I mean, we actually had one here in the studio once or twice in the past.
It's actually got two limitations that you wouldn't expect.
Uh-huh.
You have to be really careful about repeated notes, because it can't do them past a certain rate.
Mm.
And so I try to avoid repeated notes, and it's not really good at fast pianissimo.
So passages. When it plays fast, it wants to play loud.
It drops notes, yeah.
Okay.
So you have to learn, kind of like for any other instrument, you have to learn what it will do and what it won't do. So.
Right. Well, now, we mentioned Conlon Nancarrow and his player piano pieces of mm-hmm. the mid-20th century. As you say, big influence on your work. He felt that his pieces could not be played by people. Nowadays, we have people who will arrange and play his music.
Mm-hmm.
Are you thinking maybe down the road, another generation or two, that there might be somebody out there, I don't know, somebody with three hands instead of two who might be able to play some of your pieces?
Well, I don't know about why anyone would do it. I enjoy watching the disc clavier so much because the keys move.
Right.
And you get to see all the patterns as the notes go by and everything. There are very few pianists I could enjoy as much as I enjoy watching a disc clavier. And so I don't know why people feel a need to arrange Nancarrow's music for performance, and the late studies have never been arranged for performance. I mean, he's got a piece that the tempo relationship is E against pi. Now, how are you gonna, those are both not only irrational numbers but transcendental numbers. How are you going to get somebody to conduct that? What's the?
How do you compose that? Let alone conduct?
I don't know. I've never, given the 1950s technology he was working with, I've never figured out how he did those tempo relationships.
Wow.
And he didn't. He claimed not to remember. So.
We're speaking with Kyle Gann, who for many years was an important observer and documenter of the downtown music scene, and your forthcoming book is called Music Downtown.
Mm-hmm.
When you started writing for The Voice, what was your, you know, what was your beat? I mean, were you basically assigned downtown? Or?
Yeah, my job description was real simple, and I've never forgotten it. Doug, I came and met with Doug Simmons. He said, go to three or four concerts a week, write about whatever you want. And then he said, as an afterthought, he said, it's expected that you'll cover the downtown scene.
Okay.
And that was the job description.
When was this?
That was November 1986.
86.
Yep.
Okay. So in 86, I mean, the scene was already beginning to bubble a bit. And, you know, it was, I guess, a pretty active scene.
Oh yeah,
that you were diving into.
It was right in mid swing. It was, you know, it started out with minimalism had been the big movement of the 70s.
Right.
And then by around 1983, it had swung towards free improvisation. And then soon after I came, it starts with the Bang on a Can Festival. It starts swinging back towards ensemble, notated ensemble music again.
Right. So. Now, were you already a composer by that point?
Yep. So I've been composing since I was 13.
And did you find that your work as a critic was, I don't know, getting in the way of composing? Was it affecting the types of music you ended up writing?
I'm not sure. Well, it does affect it a little bit. I think every critic composer finds himself so close to other styles that you end up kind of having an aversion reaction, that you start veering away from what other people are doing.
Hmm.
So in that sense, not attracting me towards anything, but sort of governing what I decide not to do.
Huh. Well, now there are just the fact that you could say other critic composers. There is a tradition of the critic composer. I mean, I guess it goes back to,
well, especially at The Voice.
Oh, really?
Yeah, with Carmen Moore in the 60s, Tom Johnson in the 70s, and Greg Sandow in the 80s.
True. So. But I'm thinking, you know, even going back to like Berlioz.
Yeah, and Schumann. And,
a couple of hundred years worth. In your new book, you have a chapter on Virgil Thompson, great American composer, who was also a very prominent critic.
Well, it's one of my articles on Virgil Thompson. It's because these are all articles that were from the Village Voice, except there's a big introduction to the book, but...
Well, one of the things that that you quote Virgil Thompson saying was, he was asked why he became a critic, and he said, the general standard of music reviewing in New York had sunk so far that almost any change might bring improvement, which, snarky though it may be, you know, is a nice line. Then Virgil Thompson went on to say, also, I thought that perhaps my presence in a post so prominent might stimulate performance of my works.
Yeah.
Now, that seems to me a completely unrealistic expectation.
Yeah, it was. And years later, when he retired, Peggy Glanville Hicks asked him about that. And he said, she said the same thing about her becoming a critic. And he said, baby, I sucked that lemon dry.
So in your...
It didn't happen for him. And I don't... You know, it's like for anybody, any musician whose day job is in music becomes to be seen as an intermediary, not an end in themselves. And so, like, if you were a composer, you know, it'd be the same thing. People start to think of you as somebody who can do something for them, not somebody they do something for. So
you were someone who was seen as a tastemaker, someone who could give a leg up to an emerging composer.
Right.
You were not seen necessarily as someone, oh, I should play some of this guy's music on my next concert.
Right.
So, In fact, it's
the same thing for people like Ben Neal and Bernadette Speech, who were curators at the Kitchen and things like that. So,
becoming a critic, maybe not such a great career move for a composer?
Well, it raises your visibility really quick and then leaves it there.
So have you had instances where producers or presenters actually have shied away from presenting your work because maybe you...
Oh, yeah.
Maybe you slam them in The Voice at some point?
Well, not actually. I'm sure that's true. But actually what I've been more aware of is people say, you know, we'll do a bunch of commissions. And they said, we would have loved to have commissioned you, but it didn't want to seem like we were sucking up to the critic. So I actually hear more about it from friends than I do from opponents. So.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we're speaking with Kyle Gann. There are two new records, and we can talk about Long Night in a moment. But as we head on into a break, here's a little more from Kyle's studies for the instrument known as the disc clavier, this sort of updated version of the player piano. The album's called Nude Rolling Down an Escalator, and this piece is called Bud Ran Back Out.
WNYC is supported by the IFC Center at 6th Avenue at 3rd Street, the historic Waverly Theater reborn as a state-of-the-art movie theater, Me, You, and Everyone We Know, winner of the Camara d'Or at Cannes and the Originality of Vision Award at Sundance, now playing at select theaters. Cowan, Leibowitz, and Lattman, with nearly 50 years' experience in intellectual property law, litigation, and commercial law. Cowan has expanded into customs, international trade, and transportation law. Details at CLL.com.
On Sunday afternoons after church, my mom would take me and my sisters to meet my dad. My father was a bus driver. He worked for the TA, and we would ride the route with my dad. And for a while, his route was right on Fifth Avenue in Park Slope in Brooklyn. Now I live right near Fifth Avenue along my dad's old bus route. But I tend to walk. We're New York Public Radio, WNYC.
Listening to Soundcheck at 93.9 WNYC and online at WNYC.org. I'm John Schaefer. In the background is some of Long Night, a composition by my guest Kyle Gann. This a work for three pianos. Kyle's other new release is a set of works for the Disclavier, a computer-operated player piano of sorts. And he's got a forthcoming book called Music Downtown, due in a couple of months from the University of California Press. Kyle, with the Disclavier, the attraction is the ability to write very dense thickets of different rhythms that are going, you know, mm-hmm. at different tempos and in different meters. With this piece, it's just three pianos. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem to be in a great hurry to go anywhere. And yet, if you listen, there are three different tempos going here, too.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the idea. You know, I've been interested in different tempo music, multi-tempo music, ever since I discovered Charles Ives' Three Places in New England when I was 15. That was just the idea of those two bands going at the different speeds just so fascinated me that I've spent my life trying to get that effect some way or another.
And Charles Ives in that piece was in turn recreating a famous, I guess, example of his father's
right.
ear-stretching exercises,
right.
having one band at one end of Main Street in Danbury, Connecticut, and another
right.
band in the other end, and they sort of march towards each other.
Yeah.
So that idea of music at cross-purposes with itself, but somehow becoming more than the sum of its parts, is that what you're aiming for with these different rhythms?
Actually, there are two things. Basically, there's a certain kind of textural quality that I frequently get from it that I like. And also just the idea of, it's kind of a super counterpoint. You're listening to different things, different lines at the same time, and they're not even coordinated. So it's an even further stretch of your listening powers. And yet you put them, I like to put them all in the same key and have them very harmonious. So
mm-hmm.
harmonically, it's not that unusual, but trying to keep track of the different lines that don't fit together is the challenge to listening.
Yeah. So it's almost like, composers for hundreds of years have sort of inserted little games or puzzles for their listeners. I mean, there are medieval composers who hid different, you know, popular tunes or their own name or, you know, somehow put something into their music.
Yeah.
And you've done a lot of writing about that sort of thing, too.
Yeah.
Weird, you know, non-retrograde inversions of rhythms and stuff like that.
Right.
I mean, you know, these terms will occasionally appear in some of your criticism. And
well, they're always fun to write about.
Yeah.
I don't use them myself. For Nancarrow, the player piano allowed him to do all these tremendous structural works where the same rhythm would come back at a different speed along with itself and everything. For me, the Disclavier, for me, It made me want to compose very spontaneously, and I could, because no matter where you put a note, no performer has to deal with it, so you can sort of like just painting on a canvas and do whatever you want. And I started composing once I got the Disclavier without any preconception. Just start one day, okay, now where do I want to go next?
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, now you've also done a series of works over the years that look at Native American culture and,
mm-hmm.
and specifically the Lakota Sioux.
Mm-hmm.
Are you part Native American yourself?
I've got some Cherokee blood.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Was that, how did you, I mean, how did this particular subset of your work develop?
That actually came in response, because when I was doing Long Night, I had three pianos at three different tempos. I had them watching silent blinking metronomes, which I hated doing. And then I discovered Zuni and Hopi Pueblo music that they like keep two or three different tempos in their heads at one time and jump back and forth between them.
Really?
And yeah, and that struck me as a way you could have multi-tempo conceptions in an ensemble piece without having people try to play different things at the same time, without having people watching metronomes or two conductors or something like that. So it was actually American Indian music solved that rhythmic problem for me and gave me a way to do what I wanted to do in ensemble music.
So what sounds, on the surface at least, like a modernist, experimental musical idea had actually existed for centuries in this traditional music of the Southwest.
Yep.
And is that, I've always wondered this about you've written so many different types of music, from this clavier to these lovely piano pieces to the Native American works. What ties it all together for you? Is it this kind of layering of different rhythmic possibilities?
Largely, it's the greater sort of chromaticism of tempos and pitches, both trying to, we got in the West, we got the grid of quarter notes and eighth notes, and we've got the grid of the 12 pitches, and I'm interested in making the grid finer and getting in between all those distinctions.
Mm-hmm.
So, to me, it feels like I'm writing the same piece over and over again, but I realize that most people, my music would sound very different.
Yeah. Well, and some of it is actually in different tunings,
yeah.
which we haven't actually mentioned yet.
Well, the disc clavier is that I on the recording is tuned to an 18th century well temperament.
So. Mm-hmm. So it's a subtly different tuning. But you've also done pieces where, as soon as the music starts, people are like, what?
Yeah.
Now, as a writer yourself, a longtime writer for the Village Voice and, doing program notes for symphonies and stuff like that, do you do a lot of composing of pieces that incorporate text?
Well, actually, I love using text. I've always been a big poetry fanatic, and I've got two chamber operas I wrote with librettist Jeff Sechel, and we're doing one more. It's going to be a evening-length trilogy. We did one of them in St. Petersburg in Moscow, and we haven't done the second one yet. We're going to wait to get all three of them together, and the Custer and Sitting Bull piece. And yeah, I love using text.
Mm-hmm. With Custer and Sitting Bull, that was a text that you sort of assembled.
That was historical materials that I put together, yeah.
Yeah. Well, now, Kyle Gann's new book is called Music Downtown. You have followed the downtown music scene for like 20 years or more. When did you first come to New York?
I came to New York in 1986.
Okay.
But I had been writing at the Chicago Reader since 1983.
Mm-hmm. So almost 20 years of watching the downtown scene.
Yeah.
How's it changed?
Well, the nature of the downtown scene, I think, is that composers come in waves. And so like every 4 or 5 years, it completely turns over. And the people who were there, who were ascendant before, are still kind of hanging on the fringes and doing stuff. But a new generation comes in. It always seems to be people in their late 20s, early 30s, who have all the energy, and everybody else kind of does what they can for a while and then retreats. I think I sort of reached my point of obsolescence when DJing became an art form, and I admire it. I don't know how they do it, but I don't know how to write about it. And so that was kind of the signal that maybe my generation was ready to move on.
The sunset was waiting for you. Well, now, at the beginning, there was still a lot being written and said about the dichotomy between uptown and downtown. Mm-hmm. Uptown, academic, very modernist, thorny, dissonant music. Downtown, this kind of, anything goes, drawing from jazz, rock, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that still pertains?
Yeah, I think it really does. I mean, people are always trying to convince me that it doesn't, but actually, up where I am at Bard College, I'm surrounded by uptown composers, and I listen to them. I know what their attitudes are. I know what kind of arguments we get into. I know when they dislike music, why they dislike it. And I know, you know, I dislike other music for complimentary reasons. In fact, there was a really nice piece by Jennifer Higdon in New Music Box. I'm sure you can still.
That's the online music magazine, newmusicbox.org.
About why she grew up not liking Cage's music. And, you know, Cage is sort of the patron saint of downtown. It's almost a litmus test. If you're into Cage's music, you're probably a downtowner. And it was a really revealing self-analysis of why she doesn't like that music.
And she's a Chicago-based composer. So, I mean, I think the point here is uptown, downtown, no longer geographic.
Oh, it's not. It's never really been a geographical issue.
It's a state of mind thing.
It started out, it's a performance practice too.
Right.
It's how, you know, it's like even what you wear to the performance, what kinds of things you'll use in a performance, how much vernacular resource you'll use.
Yeah.
You know, whether you're trying to write string quartets or whether you're doing things with samples of, you know, things you hear in the streets.
So. Right. We're speaking with Kyle Gann. His two new releases are Long Night, a work for three pianos, and the album Nude, Rolling Down an Escalator, a series of studies for Disclavier. The forthcoming book is Music Downtown, which is due when exactly?
They started telling me September. It may be a little later than that. You can pre-order it on Amazon, which is kind of a weird concept to make. Because what if you order it now and then, you know, you get hit by a bus next month? Does my book still come?
I think if you get hit by a bus next month, the book coming is going to be the least of your worries.
The only thing I pre-order is the Simpsons DVDs, because those I have to have whether I'm alive or dead.
Okay. So. Well, let me just finally, Kyle, ask you about the title of this piece, Nude Rolling Down an Escalator. What's the meaning of that title?
Well, this piece was, I just got inspired to do a joke about modernism, because modernism for me, from my generation, a lot of my generation, is this big, hairy style that we were all expected to ride in, and we just burned out on it. And so I just decided to kind of make fun of it. And I was thinking about this being the end of modernism, what was the beginning of modernism, and Nude Descending a Staircase came to me.
Marcel Duchamp.
Yeah, the Marcel Duchamp painting. And so I just, all right, this nude's rolling down an escalator. And I couldn't just say nude descending an escalator because it didn't sound rambunctious enough.
Uh-huh.
So I just pictured somebody naked falling down an escalator.
All right. So if the nude descending a staircase was the beginning of modernism.
Yep. I was trying to close the book on it.
The ending is just as elegant. Here is the piece from Kyle Gann. Kyle, always a pleasure to speak with you. Congratulations.
Oh, you
too, two new records and a book on the way. Good
Thank
to see you.
You
again.
Good to see you.
This is Soundcheck. Thank you.